Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point. There's nothing new about change. Just ask the ancient Greek philosopher Heraclitus. He's the fellow who said you can't step into the same river twice, but the fast, vast, and constant change around us today would have made Heraclitus's head explode. My guest today says we can't fight it. What we need to adapt is an elastic mind. A mind that lives for the new and different. This hour on Point, how to think in a time of change and how to think about the change. You can join us on air or online. For starters, where are you on this? Are you already swamped and wishing things would slow down? Loving the constant storm of new facts, new apps, new challenges? Do you see us changing the way we think and operate in the chaos of our computer screens? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from New York is Leonard Mlodinow. He's a theoretical physicist, screenwriter, and author of 5 best-selling books, including The Grand Design, which he wrote with the late Stephen Hawking. He was also a writer on Star Trek: The Next Generation. His new book is called Elastic, Flexible Thinking in a Time of Change. And if you go to our website, onpointradio.org, you'll find an excerpt. Leonard Mlodinow, pleasure to have you with us.
Great to be here, Ray.
We should begin by defining the elasticity that you're talking about, because brain scientists have been talking about elasticity for a long time, but they meant the brain's ability to lay down new synapses, to recover from trauma, to create new tissue after you've already matured. That's not exactly what you mean.
Right. I'm not talking about the physical elasticity of your brain and the interconnections, although that has to happen in order to change your thinking. But what I'm talking about is the elasticity of the thinking itself. There are three ways that biological organisms process information. The most primitive way, and the one that's used most commonly in species from insects to mammals, is scripted thinking, or in humans often called fixed action patterns, where there's a trigger in the environment and you react to that in a fixed manner. For example, when you're driving to work on autopilot, the stop sign, a certain image will hit you and you'll just turn right without even thinking and you go to work. A more sophisticated way of thinking is analytical or logical thought, which is very highly valued in our society. It's what they test on the SAT. Schools are looking for it. Employers are looking for it. It's how you get from your premise A to conclusion B, C, D, et cetera, following the rules of logic. And that method of thinking is also good, but both of the methods, scripted and logical thinking, are really tailored for situations that you've seen before. But when something happens that changes the circumstances, or it's a new challenge, or it's a problem that is not of the type you've seen before, where you need a new paradigm or a new approach to it, that's when you need elastic thinking. And elastic thinking is the kind of thinking that integrates new ideas, depends on associations in your mind, creativity, imagination, integrating ideas from different areas. It's the kind of thinking where you're inventing rules or breaking rules or realizing that rules must be broken. The old ones don't apply. It's not following rules. When you're driving to work, you're following rules of logic to plot your path, or you're following your autopilot to get to work. But it's elastic thinking that brought us the car.
Have there been other epochs in the life of humankind where there have been challenges, insults, calamities that rewarded elasticity? Have we already had winnowing out earlier in our life as a species where we faced maybe the kind of sudden change in the nature of the challenge, so that we, as a species, have already had some experience with this?
Well, that's a good question. One can ask, why do we have this ability evolutionarily? What would have brought it on. And actually, human beings are not the most physically fit animals. Every animal has its own ecological niche, and it's good at something. And our strength is not our strength. It's not our physical strength. It's not our speed. It's our mind, and in particular, it's our exploratory and inventive and innovative qualities that allowed us to make tools, that allowed us to find new sources of water or be aware of new sources of water and food because we explored rather than sitting and depending on the sources that always worked. And what happened was about 100,000 years ago, there was a great climactic catastrophe, climate change that caused big problems for the human species, and our numbers dwindled down to almost nothing. Some say there may be 1,000 left, some say hundreds, some say dozens. And humans that lived then, they were in Africa, had trouble finding food and water due to the climate change, and only certain groups survived, and they were the ones that had a certain variation of a certain gene that we now know is called DRD4, which controls the dopamine regulation in the reward system in your brain. And those people who were more exploratory and loved new things and liked change were more apt to go around and find other places to live and other environments. And they explored more and they traveled more. And this allowed them to find a way to survive that catastrophe. And after the climate got better again, they started spreading all around the world. So the people who did not have the exploratory gene or tendency tended to die off, and those who had the greater tendency survived and started exploring and scattering around the world. And ever since then, we've had this ability and this desire to explore, to try new things, and that's part of our human nature. But through most of civilized human history, that really was somewhat dormant because people's lives were very mundane and routine. If you, 100 years ago, if you could be, you might work in an assembly line, you might be plowing fields. If you were traveling from New York to Ohio, it might take you 2 weeks before there were cars in a covered wagon. And life was very mundane. And through the 20th century, things started to pick up and change started to happen. Technology came. We became exposed to other cultures through media, magazine, eventually radio and television. Our jobs tended to get more interesting and challenging. And especially in the last, say, 20 years, that's just exploded. And the change is now coming so fast that it's challenging our ability to cope and to survive. And so in order to thrive, we've really have to rely on this ability for elastic thinking as never before.
You told us about a winnowing down during a time of natural crisis. And we've been reaping the genetic benefit ever since. Sami live north of the Arctic Circle. Tuaregs make their way across the vast expanses of the dry and incredibly hot Sahara. We adapt and we know how. Are you talking about maybe another winnowing where we even refine down further and the most successful among us are the people who, yes, like all of us, have that possibility, have that tendency, but have it even more?
Well, what happens in a civilized society is not a winnowing so much of the gene pool by people dying off, but there's an economic winnowing. And what's happening today is that companies and employees and all of us who work and have to exist in the workforce are becoming more successful if we are good at elastic thinking, if we're good at adapting, if our minds can deal with change, if we can learn and absorb new ideas. And those who don't fall down on the economic ladder.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking this hour to Leonard Mlodinow. He's the author of Elastic, and we're talking about how flexible thinking works in a time of change. You can join us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Is this something you can train yourself to do? Or are we talking about people who, deep in their neurological profile, deep in their DNA, lurks a tendency that might be more pronounced than in others?
Well, there are individual differences in our abilities for elastic thinking and in our desire and enjoyment to take on new challenges. But Yes, we can also adjust that. We can change that. We can change the way we think. There's a lot of it depends on our mindset and on the external conditions, on the physical environment, and there are ways to work on the way you think in order to think more elastically.
We're talking about how to adapt to this time of second-by-second change. Jaso writes on our website, I would ask a different question. Is it desirable to keep up with the pace of information flow? Is the qualitative nature of this increasing flow of data equivalent to the more fundamental data upon which we formerly relied and acted? Are our lives improved by learning to absorb and accommodate a growing influx of information? What do you think, Leonard?
Well, whether or not the change that's happening is good or bad, it is not good if you don't know how to deal with it. If, you know, when you get a new phone app or a new computer app or a new device that you buy, you know, they used to come with manuals and it told you in a very logically laid out way how to operate it and how it works. Today, quite often, we're challenged with new devices or new apps that they don't really have or they have very cursory instructions. We have to explore the app and figure out how it works or it's not going to work for us. We have to have that braveness to go after it and to try things on the computer to see what this does, what that does, and to figure out how things work. But if you don't have that, then you get lost and you make mistakes. You might even, if you're using your email, you might fall for a phishing attempt and end up with your computer locked out. All sorts of horrible things can happen. So if we don't know how to adapt, it's just bad news.
What kind of mind works best, copes best with the changing demands of our society? You can join the conversation. Who around you, in your family, your workplace, seems to have the knack for adapting to these times? Could the kid who can't sit still in class be better adapted to these times than the once celebrated, methodical, focused kid who dots all the I's and crosses all the T's in a term paper? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
Hi, I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Mindy Thomas.
And together, we bring you Wow in the World,
NPR's podcast for families.
Every week, we explore wild and new scientific discoveries.
We also ride a bird. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. My guest today says we all need to learn to think flexibly if we want to survive in a world that we've created, a world of constant change like never before in history. You can join the conversation. Are you sitting back, scratching your head, trying to figure out how to work, to find work, how to pay your bills in the digital economy? Do you think you can make your mind more elastic, as my guest suggests? And what do we lose when we give up the tried and true, the familiar? Find us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Leonard Mlodinow's new book is called Elastic, Flexible Thinking in a Time of Change, and we'll begin in Bryson City, North Carolina. Eric, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you guys for having me. Love the conversation. Just two little anecdotes I wanted to throw out there that have helped me gain and keep an elastic mind. I'm 30, and there's no such thing as bad weather, only improper attire. I've loved that. An old man told me that a long time ago. I feel like that's sort of an elastic thought. You know, weather's great all over the world. You just got to have a coat or shorts or flip-flops or good boots, you know? And then the second anecdote is, doesn't matter if you screw up. It's all about how you correct. I'm a raft guide sometime during the summer. It's like a whitewater raft guide. It's a fun job, but that's something they taught us, and it kind of applies to the real world, too. You know, if you mess up, it's all about corrective action and listening to the environment.
I would think safe whitewater rafting is rewarded by elasticity. Leonard Mlodinow, the ability to quickly adapt to changing circumstances.
Well, I love that comment, especially the way you look at the weather and the improper attire, because a very important aspect of elastic thinking is how you look at things and how you can dig up your point of view and examine it and understand how you're looking at things and how changing it might help. Because quite often when we have a challenge in life or an issue, the solution is really easy once you understand the false assumptions that you're making or the way you're framing the problem in the wrong way and change that, and then suddenly the answer takes no thought at all. I think a riddle is a good metaphor for that. That's really the way riddles work. Think about this riddle. Marcia and Jane were born at the same time of the same parents, but they're not twins. What's going on? Now, that's not a trick question, and the answer is really easy once you get past a hidden assumption that you're making that you probably don't even realize that you're making. So the answer is that they're triplets. And the reason that riddle is difficult, and the reason that most riddles take some thought, is that when I say Marcia and Jane are blah, 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 you're picturing Marcia and Jane. You're picturing two girls or two women in your mind, a pair. And that is an implicit assumption that you're making, that they are a pair, which makes them twins, which makes the riddle impossible to solve. Once you recognize that you're making that assumption and you let go of it, then the answer is very easy. They could be triplets, they could be quadruplets or whatever. And that really happens in a lot of life. It happens in the way you look at things. It happens in your personal life. It happens in your job. Sometimes you have an issue in life and you get stuck and you don't know how to get around it. But then if you examine your life, maybe you go to therapy and you examine your life deeply enough, you realize that there are some assumptions or frameworks that you have that you're not aware of. And then if you change those, the answer is easy.
Reedsboro, Vermont is next. John, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for taking my call today. I had a comment regarding technology and how it's outstripped our biology and our way to think. So inherently, technology is made to assist in humans' physical limitations. So we had the plow, right? So we could spend more time around the dinner table connecting and caring. We have the airplane, so we can now fly. Amazing inventions, medicine, great, longer bridges. We can connect people. But the problem with this technology, Ray, is that it's usurping our mind and our ability to imagine and our cognitive faculties. So I really don't care how elastic you are. If we can't focus, if we can't look at each other in the eye and sit down and solve problems with our own brain, not algorithms, but our creative faculties, what technology did before to enhance our physical limitations allowed us to do so, then I think we're headed in a very dark place. So it doesn't matter how elastic we are. We're going to have to take a step back, Ray, and really reassess what's beneficial to the human thought process. Thank you very much.
John, let me agree with you that we don't ask enough questions about why we do some of the things we do. But I'm wondering, as you were talking, I was listening very closely and thinking about how now I ride around with my GPS in the car, and I wonder, does the fact that it's there doing some of that thinking for me free me up for other things or erode my ability to develop a sense of direction, a memory of how I drove this way the last time? It's whether it's an upside question or a downside question. John, what do you think? Am I using a crutch or am I freeing up my mind for other more profitable endeavors?
Well, I think it's you have to use a balance. So if you're going to use a GPS, I would look at a map first and flex that part of the brain that understands that spatial plan view perspective. Then you can use the GPS. If you're just dependent on the GPS without actually understanding how the plan view perspective works, again, we're losing our human faculties. And the more and more of these aids, GPS, social networks, which let's not kid ourselves, they aren't penicillin. I mean, they aren't, you know, the great skyscrapers of the 20s. They aren't the humankind that was really pushing forth, uniting, creating great things. But these GPS-like faculties, Ray, continue to grow more and more. So we're not using our brains. We're allowing the technology to think for us. And I don't think that's just a problem in terms of being lazy. I think it's a problem in terms of actually solving real creative problems that we need to solve in the next decade.
Leonard Milano now?
Well, technology can be an aid and it can also deter us from doing things. The GPS can really help you get where you need to go, and it's a lot easier to use than the old Thomas Guide where you used to have a book and you look up on the map where you're headed. But when When you get too reliant or too connected to your technology, that is a problem. There's a whole field called eye addictions now, where people have been studying what happens to people when, for instance, you get your cell phone taken away, you don't have any access to your Instagram account all of a sudden. And this actually causes great problems in people. They've seen that the effect of losing your cell phone is similar to the effect of an addict not getting the drug. It actually affects the dopamine centers in your brain. And so you can get too close to the technology, and that can be almost physically addictive. But with regard to elastic thinking or to creative thinking, which is a part of elastic thinking, technology can be a big problem, because one thing that you need if you're going to be creative is an expanse of time in which you're not interrupted and your mind is not focused on something. Creativity stems from a defocused state in which the ideas are brewing in your unconscious mind and they pop into your consciousness. Your brain is an idea machine, and it's constantly coming up with associations and ideas for whatever you're thinking about, for solving your problem, for things that you might want to do and act on. And there are so many ideas being generated that your brain has filters that keep them from coming to your consciousness, because if they all came to your consciousness, you would drown in these ideas. You wouldn't be able to function. And these filters let the more conventional, more traditionally promising ideas through and keep the crazy, distracting ideas away. But even though some of those ideas that they're keeping away might be crazy, silly ideas that you don't really want to consider, some of them aren't. They're original. They're new ideas. They're new ways of looking at things. And in order to be creative, you have to relax those filters and let some of those weird ideas through to get an original idea. And in order to do that, you need to defocus your mind. You need to relax. You need to not focus on a sound, a sight, an idea, something you have to do. And technology can get in the way of that. If you have your phone and you're thinking you want to check your email, or you hear the beep that you have a new text message, that or even the thought that might happen, or the idea that you might want to check your cell phone, can totally take away this defocusing and turn the cognitive filters back on. So technology, if it's interrupting us, if it's always our partner, can be very destructive to creativity.
That's my cue to bring another voice into the conversation. Nir Eyal worked in Silicon Valley for many years. He now blogs at nearandfar.com. He's author of the book Hooked: How to Build Habit-Forming Products, and he's now finishing up a book on how to stay focused and creative in an age of information overload. And the book will be called Indistractable. Nir, welcome. What do you think of what you just heard from Leonard Mlodinow?
Hi, Ray. Pleasure to be here. There's so much I agree with Dr. Mlodinow about, and I think in particular this point around how technology can be a force for creativity. It can help us expand our minds. It can expose us to ideas that we may not agree with and test those assumptions that we hold that Dr. Mlodinow says can impede us from having an elastic mind by exposing us to new ideas. But then I also agree as well that the cost of all that exposure and connectivity is that at times we can have difficulty focusing and disconnecting. So I think that in order to put technology in its place, we're going to have to find the proper balance. And I think that starts with scheduling time for something that used to come naturally, which is boredom. It used to be that
right.
In times past, it was a constant, we constantly had to deal with boredom, where I think now we're going to schedule it in our lives to allow our minds to wander.
But Nir, you, I think both of you have hinted at this. We're pushing back against an environment that's being engineered to not allow us to have that boredom, to create products that are viral, to create products that are addicting. There are new stats on how many times a day people are touching their phones, and it's north of 120 times a day. You have to be mindful about this, because, in fact, the industry is pushing you in the other direction.
Right, and that's the subject of my book, Hooked, is exactly how do these companies do it. The fact is they're not going away, right? We can moan about what these companies do to us, but the fact is that they're here to stay. And so I agree with Dr. Lotti now that we have to learn how to adapt, and that is the human species' ultimate feature, is that we can adapt. And so I think this is just another thing that we are going to have to adapt to. And frankly, distraction is nothing new. Aristotle and Socrates talked about akrasia 2,500 years ago, about this tendency that human beings have to do things against their better interest. And frankly, if it wasn't Facebook, it would be the television or the radio or salacious novels or some other distraction. So this is just the latest incarnation that I'm sure the species will adapt to.
And Omaha, Nebraska is our next stop. Kimberly, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I'm wondering, if you are an elastic thinker, what is the best way to communicate your new ideas to people that don't think outside the box and are resistant to change?
Well, that is the challenge. One of the topics I talk about is how it is important to your elastic thinking to expose yourself to other ideas, to dissent, to talk to people who disagree with you, and to take their ideas seriously, not to just dismiss them. Now, how do you get people who don't have the will to do that to do it? That's a good question. I'm not sure I know the answer. That's a problem that we have in society today. I think it's extremely important that we do all learn to look at the other side. And it's not only important for us for harmony in society, but it's important for your own thinking, because the more you're exposed to other ideas, other cultures, other ways of thinking, the broader your own thinking it is, and the more imaginative and creative you'll be, and the more adaptable you'll be. So it's a good thing for everyone to do. But of course, the first step is to get people to want to do it.
Aren't there already plenty of contexts for human work and human interaction that reward the old inelastic self?
Well, there are contexts like that, but they're becoming fewer. And even, in most of your life and most work situations, you don't need either elastic thinking or logical analytic thinking. It's a combination of both. You have to have elastic thinking to question your assumptions, to invent new paradigms, new frameworks for looking at things, to adapt. But then you need to channel at some point that thinking toward a goal, toward a product. And so then you need to use your logical analytic thinking. Your brain works both from the top-down manner, which has executive structures that act like the CEO or the boss or the general that direct other structures what to do on the large scale. But it's hierarchical. So all those structures are made of substructures, which are made of substructures all the way down to neural networks of individual neurons. And those are always working and bubbling around and producing ideas that come from the bottom up. They are undirected. They work according to certain rules, but they work in a way where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, and ideas just appear. And you need this bottom-up thinking along with the top-down thinking in order to be effective.
Is there a Goldilocks problem when it comes to just what you described, that if you are too much someone who has things popping into their head, who's saying, what about, you're not only maladapted to a lot of work and interaction, you may even be, insane.
Well, there's a trait that psychologists call schizotypy, which at the far end is like schizophrenia, where you have a lot of ideas that are constantly coming into your head and you lose touch with reality. You don't even know the good ones from the bad ones. That's where the filters don't really block anything. And you want to be a little bit away from that, because then you can't function. And if you're close to that end, you might have a lot of really interesting, new, strange ideas and be very creative and original. If you're at the other end, you might be stuck in conventional ideas and have trouble adapting. And, there are sweet spots that you can live in, and it depends on, first of all, your taste, where you want to be, and your job. But where you are in the scale has a big effect on how easy or difficult it is for elastic thinking.
Leonard Mlodinow and Nir Eyal are with me. We're asking whether we as humans need to adapt our brains, our minds, to this time of light-speed change. With advances in what we know about the working of our brains, are we even sure these adaptations are completely voluntary? You can join the conversation. Is this a case of If you can't beat them, join them? Or do you think one day the mad digital rush will be over and the world will need steady-as-she-goes people like you? Or are you so young you don't even really know what we're talking about here? I'm Ray Suarez. This is On Point.
When C.C. Wong met his mom's new tenant, he never suspected he'd end up getting replaced as a son, or that his replacement might have sinister motives. This week, Invisibilia looks at the things we don't say to our loved ones and the misunderstandings it can lead to. Listen on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez. We're talking about learning to embrace the storm of new apps, updates to websites, all the changes in how we work and interact that are now part and parcel of everyday life. You can join the conversation. Is my guest Leonard Mlodinow right? Is it on us to adapt or die? Or for many, will this just be unsustainable? Is the challenge absorbing everything new or sorting out what's good and what's garbage in the flood of changes in our lives? Follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are Leonard Mlodinow, author of Elastic, Flexible Thinking in a Time of Change. Also joining me, Nir Eyal, author of Hooked and the forthcoming Indistractable. From Twitter, regular person writes, if you're not flexible, you fall down the economic ladder. So the successful, the wealthy, are the ones with the most flexible minds, according to Mlodinow. This is pure social Darwinism, blaming the poor for being poor. Christopher writes, what about the issue of planned obsolescence, which seems to have become the dominant business model of our age? When those tools we use and rely on every day, especially those dependent on software, become outdated so quickly, all too often, moments after you bring them home, how elastic must we be to keep up? And Third Way Forward writes, elasticity is also related to resilience. The more options you perceive, the more likely that you'll find one that works. Try everything and keep what works. Green Maine is our next stop this hour. Lou, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi Ray. My comment is a shout out to those of us who feel technology responsibility to be easier. And I'm going to give two examples. One example is a shout out against computer programmers who, when they redesign a program, move stuff around so it takes you an hour, a half a day, a week to find the things. Or a better example is we rent about 20 vehicles a year, and each one has a dashboard full of big symbols that can only be interpreted by reading a 110-page service manual. I've taken photographs of the dashboards and put them on Facebook just as a joke to see if people can figure out what the symbols meant. Our philosophy is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So I'd like a comment about technology's responsibility to make life easier as well.
Leonard Mlodinow?
Well, people who design technology should, I mean, there's a lot of bad user interface design out there. I agree. And I get equally mad at bad design or at companies that change their apps, or even Apple changing the iPhone, some parts of the iPhone, for no apparent reason other than to keep changing things. So I guess you might want a new one. And that's just part of the challenges of change that we encounter today, which is why we need to have more flexible thinking. If I may make a comment about the social Darwinism, I didn't mean to imply that we live in a pure meritocracy, only that people who are flexible in their thinking have a greater chance of getting ahead than people who are rigid.
But it doesn't seem to be in the...
I'm not saying that you can rise out of poverty, that there's any magic skills you can gain to rise out of poverty. It's a very complicated situation. It's a combination of social conditions and your abilities. I mean, but I came from a family that was, my parents worked in a sweatshop. They were immigrants. I'm the first generation, the first in my family to go to college. So I understand what it's like to start there and to be able to rise up. But I also know that many other people wouldn't have had the opportunities that I had.
But is there a sort of determinism, a momentum of forward movement that's so strong that even if most people wanted to feather the brakes a little bit with their right foot, they couldn't do it?
Well, the change in our society is ever increasing, and it's, I think, going to continue increasing. It's fed by an exponential explosion of knowledge, of scientific papers, of technology, and that feeds on itself. So the more there is, the more that is going to happen in the future. And it's getting hard to cope. I don't think we can put the brakes on it. As Nair said, we can moan about it, but we can't stop it. And that would certainly be at least another book about how one might stop it. But what I'm writing about is how to cope with it.
Nair, our caller from Maine, wasn't, you know, he wasn't a Luddite. He wasn't anti-technology. He didn't want to crank his rental car of the 20 that he rents every year. He just wanted the ability to get behind the wheel of a new automobile and have it be intuitive, not have to figure out 100 different and unique to that model's symbols before he drove off the lot. That doesn't seem like too much to ask.
No, and I'm in the same exact camp as he is. I get very frustrated with bad design, and that's why I do what I do. We can't, however, conflate the two of technological progress and bad design. I mean, this is exactly why I wrote Hooked. Is, you know, I didn't want to teach Facebook and Google and Instagram how to design their products. They already know how to design the kind of products that people love to use every day. What I wanted to do is to expand those secrets out to the rest of us. Because if you think about, you know, most interfaces that we use, especially online interfaces, you know, think about the software you have to use in your job, interacting with government services or even local businesses. You know, these products don't suck us in the way that Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp and Google do. No, these products just plain old suck. So, you know, a product designed poorly in this way should be designed differently. In fact, I remember the first computer that my mom ever used was the iPad, because it did away with bad design. It did away with technology that felt hard to use. And for the first time, she could, you know, expose herself to this amazing world of apps and websites and information and email that she'd never had access to because of good design.
Savannah, Georgia is next. Ryan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. I just wanted to make a comment. I think you guys are missing one of the main culprits, I think, of the holdback of...
That's why we took your call, Ryan.
I think monotheism is to blame for a lot of this. You think about the history of a pushback against technology, a history of a pushback against science. I think starting the framework of your life from a place that denies the existence of other people's beliefs, let's say, I think it's the thing that's begot us to this place that we are now.
Well, you know, for every Tower of Babel where people are punished for trying to make a tall building, there's a Gregor Mendel, and an absolute stone monotheist and someone who was trying to unlock the secrets of creation and at the same time push us forward in understanding. I don't know. Well, what do you think, Leonard Milano?
Well, I think that that's true, and there are all sorts of people, and fortunately, we have a lot of people who appreciate science and who want to explore the universe and to find new ideas.
Because I think what Ryan is skeptical about is the kind of authority that religion presumes to speak from, and authorities. Power
authority
is being watered down, isn't it?
Authority is the antithesis of elastic thinking. So authority is really what I would equate with the scripted thinking, the kind of autopilot that you might go on. So you have certain rules. They tell you what to do, and you always have to follow them. But as soon as – and even if that is clever and well-designed, that authority, and makes sense, as soon as times start to change – You have to change your thinking, and so what is dictated by authority is only good for a little while. That's why in science, Newton was the greatest authority. He had amazing inventions and brilliant work, but he was also wrong. And we eventually got into the realm of the atom, and we realized that as great an authority he was, we have to change things, and we discovered other ways of looking at the world, other paradigms, other frameworks of thinking. And the problem with religion, if one wants to view it as something that is relevant for modern life, is that it doesn't adapt as well. And I'm saying that it doesn't adapt because not all people who believe in religion are fundamentalists who take the Bible or the Quran or whatever their documents are literally. But it is much more authority-based than, say, science is. And that is, it's hard to conform to the new world if you're going to rely on old authority.
And they are static.
The Torah, the Quran, and the Bible the documents are static. The documents, not necessarily the religions, but to the extent that they are static, or look at our Constitution. When the Supreme Court starts quoting people who wrote, you know, the original Constitution, who wouldn't know, you know, a car would seem like magic or a telephone, then you wonder, well, how relevant is that? Doesn't that have to be interpreted and changed?
Our next stop is Hilton Head, South Carolina. Helen, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I wanted to make a comment and a suggestion to everyone listening about how they can enhance their elastic thinking, creativity, and flexibility in their brains. I've always done it as a lifelong exerciser, without earbuds, without looking at a device, without looking at a television, but being outside, either running, cycling, or gardening. And that's my suggestion for generating great ideas and new ways of seeing the world. Thank you.
Helen, thanks a lot for your call. Nir Eyal, I mean, that sounds like a prescription right out of your playbook. Create a little space to think.
Absolutely. It's funny that the caller mentioned physical exercise. I take what I call thinking runs. Every week on Sunday, I go for a run here in New York City without anything to distract me. I don't have earbuds or anything to listen to. I just allow my mind to wander, and I think that's very much in line with the book Elastic, around how we need some space to consolidate our ideas and to come up with creative thoughts. And almost every time I come back from that run, I've got some new creative insight or something I want to write about or explore further.
Leonard?
Exactly, and I talk about that in detail. You call that incubation. You think about a problem, then you have to let go and let your unconscious mind work on it. And your unconscious mind is creating ideas as long as you're not focused. So a run is very good for that. You're a part of your brain called the default mode network kicks into gear when you're not thinking about something in particular. And so a run, taking a shower, going to the gym and, you know, pumping iron or whatever it is that makes you do something physically and not focus on something mentally is a great way to stimulate your brain to come up with new ideas.
That idea that Helen specifically noted, without screens, without earbuds, without tech, why is that important?
Because of distraction, not even necessarily a distraction that contains information, but any sensory input that comes to you, a conspicuous sensory input will take your brain out of that default mode and cause your brain to react to the sensory input, because we evolved having to react to the world. Well, there might be a tiger there might be a sound that means that danger is nearby, or a rock might be falling on you. We're just like other animals. We react to sensory input. But since we're civilized, our mental life is now much more important than it used to be. But in order to let our mental life live in peace, we have to sometimes keep these sensory inputs out of our lives.
Arlington, Kansas is next. David, welcome to On Point.
It's good to be with you. I have one little anecdote I'd like to relate. I lived next door for many years to a fellow by the name of Bill Crooks, who was the last surviving pilot from World War I. And he had been an engineer through most of the 1900s. He was born in the 1800s, and he didn't pass away till the 2000s. He would tell you that there is no such thing as a problem what you have is an opportunity for a new solution.
I like
that. He lived by those words. It's fun to watch. And he was just a really neat guy, and what a thinker. He was alive in three centuries, which is kind of hard to beat. And I always thought that was good.
David, thanks a lot for your call. I didn't dwell on this at great length, but is the ability for elasticity something that declines with age, Leonard?
Well, happily, no, it's actually not. With age, you actually have a better physical ability toward elasticity, and that's why older people, sometimes like younger people, do things that one might consider a little bit out of the box. And what does decline, however, are the executive functions of your brain that channel those ideas. So, for instance, my father, he had a stroke, and he was in his 70s, and it affected his mental filtering apparatus. And we were walking in a restaurant to our table, and we're all hungry, and we see food on the tables, and we want to have some, but none of us have the idea to go grab some. But he did, and he grabbed some French fries off someone's plate. And most of us that idea would not come to our consciousness, or if it did, we would suppress it. But he was more creative, and he was able to get that idea, and he did that. And happily, they excuse him. But this is one of the things that, as we get older, does not go downhill. But we still have, if we don't maintain our executive processes to channel that, then sometimes that can go haywire. But on the other end of life, kids have extremely interesting and different ideas, and they sometimes the filters don't really mature till you're 25. So younger children can sometimes act on that and do weird things that are hard to understand and that we have to scold them about or talk to them about. But at both ends of life, actually, elastic thinking is favored.
Leonard Mlodinow is the author of Elastic, Flexible Thinking in a Time of Change. Been a pleasure to have you with us, Leonard. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ray. It's been fun.
And Nir Eyal joined us, author of Hooked and the forthcoming Indistractable. Thanks for joining Leonard and me.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Ray Suarez, and this is On Point.